Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. My name is Judith Koch. I'm a PhD student in international relations at the University of Sussex, and I'm the production manager of this podcast. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
On the 29th of December 2023, the Republic of South Africa instituted proceedings in the International Court of Justice against the State of Israel relating to breaches of the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Genocide is a term that has re-entered public consciousness with full force. It has been a term around which debates have raged over its use, its applicability, and its political power. But what is genocide? To discuss this question in historical and contemporary international relations, we are joined today by Jo Bluen. Jo is an educator, writer, and PhD researcher who works on issues of colonial genocide, apartheid, and international justice. They are currently lecturing in the Department of Sociology at the University of Cape Town in South Africa and completing a PhD in international relations at the London School of Economics in the UK. Their research focuses on the intersections of apartheid and genocide, their connected oppressions and liberal fascisms, and histories in international law and global politics. They are an organizer with South African Jews for a Free Palestine and have previously worked for the Institute of Justice and Reconciliation, the London School of Economics, and Business Day. Welcome, Jo, and thank you for joining us for this latest episode of the EISA Voices podcast on what is genocide. But before we begin, I should probably tell our listeners that we are recording this before the deadline that Israel is required to supply the International Court of Justice with evidence that it has adhered to the provisional measures the court set out in its 26th of January ruling on preventing plausible genocide in Gaza. But importantly, after the court's decision on the 16th of February to not demand additional urgent measures were requested by South Africa in relation to the Israeli invasion of Rafah. My opening question, and this is a biggie, I think, my opening question is, what is genocide? And I ask this because it is invariably described differently depending on the person using it. So is it a crime, the crime of crimes determined by international law and the Genocide Convention? Is it something broader than the legal definition, as the work of Raphael Lemkin might suggest? Is it a contested scholarly field of study, or is it all of those things?
Hi, Polly. Thank you for having me and greetings to your listeners. It's really good to be here and to have the opportunity to chat with you about these really important issues. So I think your question is really, really important, and how you phrased it is really reflective of the kind of legal architecture which upholds genocide and the limitations thereof. So in the first instance, yes, absolutely. Genocide is a legal term. We look at the Genocide Convention, Article 2, I believe. It's the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial or religious group, and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, Article 6, elaborates on this as well. So we have this kind of legal framework. And absolutely, you know, when you refer to it as the crime of crimes, within legal scholarship, there is a kind of contestation about the kind of hierarchies of these crimes. But what we do know is that the violation of the Genocide Convention presents a peremptory norm, the Genocide Convention, which means that nothing excuses it, nothing justifies it. And I think important, sort of before I come to the broader context, is you know, within the legal space, complicity, genocidal complicity is also really, really an important thing to remember. So if you look at Article 3 of the Genocide Convention, things like arming Israel, you know, as many European countries are doing, as the United States is doing, this renders them in violation of the Genocide Convention. And by law, according to the Genocide Convention, it's not only that genocide is illegal, but that there is an obligation to prevent it whenever it is happening. And that is kind of the rationale behind South Africa's taking of is the State of Israel to the ICJ. Having said that, I think it's really important to kind of, you know, to recognize, and this is what, you know, I think about a lot, is the limits of the law. You know, as Zoe Samudzi says in a fantastic issue of The Funambulist called Against Genocide, you know, genocide is the crime of crimes. And I might be paraphrasing a bit here, but the fact that it's a crime is the least important thing about it. I have started to think of genocide in a few ways. The one is kind of genocide as a structure. And because of the deep colonial origins and roots and ramifications of the international legal system, genocide is already inhering in the international liberal project. So, and I'm coming back to the South African case here. You know, when the genocide case was brought, it was placed in the context of the ongoing Nakba, of apartheid, of the ongoing occupation in Palestine, which is, you know, also being argued to be illegal at the ICJ right now, as we speak. And so I think it's really important to, you know, and it's one of the tensions that I grapple with a lot is, on the one hand, there is this kind of legal architecture that is prohibiting what is really essentially very often a white supremacist or racial capitalist or cis-heteropatriarchal set of violences. And on the other hand, the very legal architecture itself has permitted these violences. So as Noura Erekat, who is a Palestinian legal scholar, says, you know, the incidence of genocide has far predated and exceeded the Genocide Convention. But it's beyond of the law. And I think really importantly, we need to recognize that the structure of colonial modernity is inherently a genocidal structure, right? So just because there wasn't a genocide convention before 1948, if we're looking from 1492, then we are looking at what is the coalescence of a set of, you know, what we could call international laws, international science, ideas of humanism, ideas of race, and how these kind of come together to allow for a legal and political architecture that permits genocide. So genocide is both a legal concept, and as a legal concept, it has political consequences. But if we think of the kind of inherent racialization of genocide and white supremacy of genocidal acts, that, you know, that it is beyond of the law.
Thank you so much. Could you tell us a little bit more about how it's seen as a scholarly field of study? Is it solely, I mean, it's a legal field of study. We have a whole sort of discipline of genocide studies. But can we also, you know, how is it understood in international relations?
I think this is such a great question, and I've been thinking about it so much, because one of the ways I think it's understood is that it isn't understood. And it's, I mean, I think there's, so I think one of my kind of very formative works in international relations was Sibo Grover-Gree's Come to Africa, A Hermeneutics of Race in International Theory. And there we have the kind of crux, you know, where the point is made that on V-Day, 1945, you know, this is drawing on Césaire and Sartre, and that, you know, the French massacred thousands of Algerians at Sétif, and these victims could not be considered victims or humans for the purposes, even though they had fought in the trenches alongside their French colonial, I suppose, compatriots. I don't know if I'm getting that wording right. And the Nuremberg trials kind of consecrating this idea, but that being excluded. So there's always, you know, I think in international relations, you have this moment, this kind of post-1945 world order idea, which, you know, whether it's the paradigmatic debates or, you know, the kind of liberal versus realist, constructivist, all these ideas that kind of emerge from this 1945 moment, in many ways echo the problematics in what has come to be known as Holocaust and genocide studies, where part of the problem is that, you know, the idea of Holocaust studies and genocide studies are kind of collapsed, which does the work of essentially collapsing the idea of genocide into a Holocaust exceptionalism, and specifically an exceptional focus on Jewish victims of the Holocaust and a particular narrative. And one of the things that we see sort of manifesting quite a lot at the moment in the discourse around Palestine is, you know, you can't accuse Israel of genocide because, you know, that was the crime done to the Jews, which obviously, and I think this requires a rethink, you know, if you read the work of Tina Kampt, for example, or the other Germans, understanding the Holocaust in the context of anti-blackness, of racial subjugation, of understanding the Nazi occupation of Europe as part of a colonial genocide, as many anti-colonial thinkers were doing in the 50s and the 40s and 60s, you know, is really important. So I think that's on the one hand around international relations. And then I think kind of as a subfield, we see it emerging in international law, where the focus, with few exceptions, is predominantly quite doctrinal. So it goes much more into the kind of, you know, the legal technicalities and the apparatus of genocide. And what I quite frankly find a really discomforting academic practice, where it's a kind of algorithmic archiving of death and the questions that we're asking, you know, how can you prove intent? How can you, you know, count bodies or show, you know, and all of these questions which, you know, for me, and I guess this is, you know, where is your grammar for mourning? Where is your grammar for honoring those who have passed, that I think is missing? Yeah, so if I were to kind of come back to the question, I think it's also a lot to do with our temporal boundaries of where we say, you know, the origins, the Westphalian state, that kind of origins of international relations, in many ways absent the fact that the very foundations of both the discipline and the practice of international relations are founded on the kind of legitimization of colonial genocide.
That neatly segues into my second question for you, which is, who is the subject of genocide?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a really interesting way of framing this question. So at the entrance to the International Criminal Court, there is a kind of, it's in the atrium, and there is this wooden plinth, and on it, it says, you know, this cause is the cause of all humanity. And it's very much framed in terms of a universal idea of a constituent we that is You know, if you look at Article 1 of the Rome Statute of the ICC, you know, where it outlines its kind of jurisdiction, it says its jurisdiction is over crimes of most grave crimes of most concern to the international community as a whole. So on the one hand, there's this idea of the international, the human. But I think, and I think this kind of segues with a lot of your work as well, Polly, and the work of kind of the Black radical tradition and anti-colonial humanism, and many feminist scholars, is, you know, kind of thinking and unpacking and deliberating on who this we is, on who this humanity is. And if you look at the work of Sylvia Winter, for example, and we talk about the overrepresentation of man as if he were the human himself, I think that's really important. And I think the failure to situate genocide within the context of apartheid or global apartheid, of global white supremacy, of global racial capitalism, of colonial genocide, speaks to a really partial we that is quite a white we, and that has historically served white interests. You know, I think there is, underlying the kind of liberal humanist recourse to universalist discourse, there is a very specific kind of colonial kinship that emerges as the constituent community. And you know, one of the things I've been reading about lately is the deliberations where in many ways the kind of who is the international community were coming to the fore at the San Francisco conference in 1945. And it was Jan Smuts who insisted on inserting the word human rights into the UN Charter. And I think there's a very interesting, you know, the idea of the human, and, you know, Smuts had studied, he was very into holism, he was very into Darwinism, and the we, the kind of human in question was very much, and this is in 45, which is 3 years before apartheid was formalized in South Africa, the kind of constituent we was very much around inter-imperial rivalries, around an establishment of a settler colonial contract that emerges. And very much, I think that is the case. And I think if you look, you know, if you look at the landing page of defendants at the ICC, you see all Black faces, whether they've been acquitted or not, which I think is also interesting. It is a carceral archive. It is an anti-Black archive. So I think there is a claim to universalism. There is a claim to the international community, but there is a definite sense that some people's crimes are more worthy of impunity than others, and some people's deaths are less worthy of legal or other redress than others.
Thanks so much. And I'm going a little off script here. There's something, I don't know, I feel there's a tension at the heart of this. So there's very definitely this sort of partial we, but at the same time, right, the legal definition of genocide very much focuses on this idea of population, sort of in whole, in part or in whole, right? So I'm wondering if you could kind of unpack that a little bit more for us and maybe then say something about how this marks genocide out as, say, maybe different from war crimes or ethnic cleansing, right? How the subject and this sort of focus on the population in whole or in part is something, therefore, that then, you know, is specific, possibly, potentially, to genocide as a particular form of violence.
So I think there, and one of the contentions is, you know, it's the idea of a particular, it's because the intention to destroy and what makes genocide the crime is because of the belonging to a certain group. So, and it's a closed list of groups, which has also been the subject of much contestation. There's kind of talk about, you know, why wasn't gender included or should gender be included? And so it is a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. And these are the kind of, I guess, the subjects. And that is What distinguishes genocide, what is said to distinguish genocide from other crimes. But I also think that, I think, so it's very interesting. Raphael Lemkin, who was the progenitor of the term genocide, was not a lawyer. He was a linguist. And he really was interested, and there's a page from his, from one of his journals, where he circles the word, he says the word, and then he connects it to moral judgment. So the idea, and I think very much coming from a particular sensibility of being an Eastern European Jew at the time of the Shoah and before, is to kind of to say there's something distinct about this, and it, as David Luban says, it kind of, the word itself emerges as something that kind of linguistically takes hold of a moral conscience. And I think that's important, and I think the question of how does this relate to war crimes is an interesting one, because yes, they are distinct, but they often take part as a composite package. The question of, forced starvation, if you're forced starvation, which is a war crime, which we're seeing a lot of in Gaza at the moment, of course, and have been, and the deliberate holding or interception of aid, there you're starving a group. So you can see them obviously as separate, but they very often happen within conversation with each other. I think one of the things that's really, really distinct for me about genocide is the particular use, the particular use of the idea of language. Again, I come back to language here. The particular use of ideas that, so one of the things that we've seen in Palestine is Israeli officials, number one, kind of using, talking about, human animals, using these very dehumanizing or unhumaning rhetorics, but also doing what has been done for a very long time in the history of genocide is accusing marginalized groups of committing genocide. So the likening of Palestinians or Hamas to Nazis, for example. Zoe Samudzi also has a great article in the Journal of Genocide Research forum on this as well. But once you make this, because, and it goes back to the kind of questions we were talking about the constellation of Holocaust and genocide studies, once you situate the Nazi Holocaust in Europe as kind of the prime epochal defining evil, the exceptional evil, then you situate Nazism as a sort of very exceptional thing, as if it's not connected to a global colonial fascism that exists in many, many connected instantiations. You also then enable the justification of any violence, which I think is part of what we're seeing happening in Palestine right now.
Fantastic. That leads me on to two other questions, and I'm still going off script now. And one is the question of intentionality, right? And I think we've seen that very clearly in the ICJ proceedings, right? That there's a need, at least legally, to be able to show intentionality. And that's what differentiates, say, genocide from other international crimes. And then the other, and as someone who's very interested in the how of things, right? So the practices of things is often what I see in the discussions or the disagreements around what constitutes genocide. And this is me speaking as a non-expert here, is the sort of, and maybe also partly feeds into this exceptionalization of the Shoah, is the how of how this murder, this elimination is carried out, right? And the sort of need to sort of focus on the sort of the modernist industrial kind of forms of slaughter, and therefore how that then leads to us, and I say us, and I mean white folks in the global north, not recognizing other genocidal eliminationist practices in the global south. So here I'm thinking about, the continued refusal by in some quarters to sort of see and understand
what happened in Namibia to the Herero and the Nama, because it didn't involve these kind of industrial levels of slaughter, right? You know, let the desert do the job for you, kind of thing. And so therefore, you know, there's still this discussion over, is this the first genocide of the 20th century, right? So I'm wondering if you can unpack a little bit more this sort of this need for intentionality. And I mean, I think you started to do that in discussing language, but also the sort of that, yeah, the how genocide takes place.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question that. So I think on the question of intent, so theoretically, genocide can take place without a single murder. And I think that's, you know, so I think the intent question is really important. And just from a legal point of view, because I think the South African submission is really, really interesting in how it handled this, because it both showed evidence of Israeli statements. First of all, it didn't do the kind of pornotrope thing of mass, you know, which Israel had initially wanted to do by showing extensive footage, which, you know, turns people's lives and deaths and resistance into spectacle. So it didn't do that. It number one showed statements by Israeli high-ranking Israeli officials, and number two connected that to actions by soldiers on the ground. So, you know, the Amalek trope, for example, which is a wildly abused biblical story, which, you know, is used to justify genocide and the Amalekites being worthy of genocide and that kind of thing, which they showed. So I think the intent thing is really key. At the same time, I mean, I struggle with it as a person sort of thinking with international relations and international theory and sociological theory about the law, because, you know, and I'm coming back to Palestine here, you know, if you take this back to 1948, if you take this back to 1917 and the Balfour Declaration, what kind of explicit intent do you need to have when you have a context of ethnic cleansing and mass murder, when you are displacing people, for example? So I think that's one thing. I think the other point, I think you're absolutely right. And I think and in fact, as we speak, I believe Namibia is also presenting oral arguments on occupation in Palestine today at the International Court of Justice. And I think the genocide of the Overherero and Nama people and the excision of it from the canon of genocide from the kind of sensibilities of how we speak about genocide is also deeply connected to the inherent anti-blackness of international relations and international law and the kind of social milieu around which this operates. So I think I think the point there that is really crucial, and that's what kind of a lot of scholars that are working on genocide studies and in connection with kind of studies of settler colonialism or colonialism more broadly or coloniality have shown us is you know that the European colonial project was a, you know, some people have this kind of I don't really subscribe to this you know, laboratory, you know, Namibia was a laboratory for the Nazi Holocaust in Europe because they were connected, right? As Césaire wrote, you know, that it was what horrified the kind of bourgeois, because I'm going to misquote Césaire and I feel terrible, but, the liberal Christian bourgeois white man was, you know, Hitlerism showed the kind of the hypocrisy that it wasn't what was done to man, but what was done to the white man, or what I would say the kind of whitened man, and so I think that's a really important point. And I think coming back to your question about international relations, I'm jumping backwards if that's okay, but is Those scholars who I think, even if they're not explicitly focusing on genocide, but who are asking us questions about how we historicize and what kind of histories we take seriously and what our relationship to history is, the kind of, you know, what I think about with Christina Sharp, and the idea of the kind of afterlives of slavery, where we think about temporality and this kind of violence, not as an event, but as a structure. And I think of that a lot. And there are, you know, you look at Olivia Rutazibwa's work on global development and that, you know, that kind of thing, where we are asked to think about how these, what appear as kind of liberal legal panacea are actually part of a structure, a genocidal structure. Yeah, so I think that, and that structure being deeply rooted in colonial modernity and the concomitant anti-blackness of it. And of course, then relatedly, if anti-blackness is seen as foundational, then other forms of racial subjugation, like anti-Semitism, which is real, extraordinarily real, it's just not the same thing as anti-Zionism, you know, that these are related harms and related subjugations and violences.
You said something really interesting there where you said, you know, there, not a single murder has to take place, right, for something to be a genocide, right? And I thought that that was also super interesting in the South African application to the ICJ, was that there was such a focus on the prevention of births. And that is exact, I mean, and that speaks to this idea, right, that if you put into place specific structures which are intended to, you know, prevent a population from reproducing itself, therefore this constitutes genocide. And I think that also speaks to the sort of the temporalities of genocide, that this is a structure. It's not an event. It is something that can take place over long periods of time. And so for, you know, the need to sort of think outside of the temporality of emergency and crisis, which is something I seem to just spend my entire life saying. Anyway, I want us to sort of maybe drill down a little bit now into the study of genocide as a kind of legal and academic concept or construct, but that does something. So there is considerable debate and divergence amongst scholars and lawyers around genocide, around what constitutes a genocide, around who gets to call something a genocide, right? It's contested history as a descriptive term and perhaps a political accusation. I was hoping you could sort of talk us through this complex and fraught history a little.
I can. Thank you. Yeah. So I just wanted to read a short quote, if I may, from Professor El Afendi, who was one of the contributors to that Journal of Genocide Studies symposium. And I think it really captures a lot of the, you know, a lot of the kind of both the fraught history, but also the fraught futurity. Because what has this field done, you know, in the face of what's going on? So let me read this. Like all fields in the social sciences, Holocaust and genocide studies has a paradoxical relationship to its subject. As a science, it must distance itself sufficiently from it to gain objectivity and authority, but it also needs to be sufficiently engaged to achieve relevance and impact. Another dilemma stems from its subfield, Holocaust studies, insisting on its singularity and uniqueness. If these characteristics are accepted, this hinders the drawing of lessons relating to prevention and the never again determination. So I think that really kind of encapsulates, you know, some of the fraught history there within the study. I think there's kind of a few different spaces in which genocide is studied or understudied or overstudied that also very rarely communicate with each other very well. So as I mentioned, you know, so I think the one thing is, you know, within the international relations space, what we know is that, and I've been watching very closely how the resistance to refer to what is very obviously a genocide in Palestine as a genocide. And part of that is because, as you know, once you say the G word, as it were, you then invite certain political consequences, you know, whether it's, you know, the duty, you know, invocation of the Genocide Convention, the duty to prevent. So I think within, and then I think a sort of a big book within international relations that made me sort of, you know, it's terrible, but Samantha Power's A Problem from Hell, which related to, you know, the Rwanda genocide and kind of the idea of you know, action happening too late, and then now just seeing, you know, repeated time and time again, the kind of refusal to take action. So I think, you know, so one of the things that happens in the field is this kind of connection to the Nazi Holocaust as well, right? And I think contemporary scholars of genocide studies, you know, looking at Dirk Moses's recent work, Zoe Samudzi, you know, this connection to colonization and colonialism, starting to think about genocide in connection with colonization. And then I think there's another kind of trajectory of thinking which happens within the law. And there's two kind of spaces that I kind of want to highlight here. And the one is the actual legal development of the concept of genocide and its application. And there we're looking at the kind of post-Lemkin commentary and then how various aspects like intentionality, like how we evaluate intention. And that is often quite dry. And often, I guess one of the problematics, I think, is that it kind of abstracts the legal deliberations of genocide from the sociopolitical context in which it exists. So I think that's one angle. Then I think the other angle, the other kind of trajectory that's come through is a kind of tribunalism-related conversation about genocide, because very often, you know, how we understand the law around genocide is through its prosecution. So the kind of evaluations of this, you know, what I call and what many call this kind of teleological journey from Nuremberg to The Hague, where we have, it's quite a civilizational discourse, and it exists in international law and international relations, where we are seeing this idea that, you know, we went from a time before 1945 where, you know, Europe kind of broke its contract with its civilizational self momentarily, because colonialism is kind of excised from that picture, and to this like new era of enlightened liberalism where genocide is taken seriously and prosecuted through, it goes via the Rome Statute 1998, and then through International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, Rwanda, the Kosovo chambers, and, you know, the ICC as the kind of crown jewel. So there's that kind of trajectory in terms of the history. Then what I wanted to kind of bring up here is actually the relationship between genocide and history itself, because you've asked me about the fraught history. And I think there are, I think part of what the question of genocide points to is how we choose to historicize, and who is we when historicization is happening. So in a fantastic article that was supposed to be at the Harvard Law Review blog by Rabia Egbaria, but then ended up getting published at The Nation because Harvard Law Review rejected it, I'm sure on purely ethical and not at all Zionist principles. I don't know if that carries in, but so they say, legal scholars tend to sharpen their pens after the smell of death has dissipated and moral clarity is no longer urgent. And in this article, you know, what they talk about is how, you know, apartheid became like a specific concept for South Africa, and genocide became a specific legal concept kind of referring to the Nazi Holocaust, and the Nakba comes as kind of should be criminalized as a specific concept for, as a specific legal concept for Palestine. But I think there, just to kind of come back to the way that history is read in through genocide, you know, the history of colonial modernity is the history of genocide. And there is a kind of disciplinary decadence that suggests that certain disciplines have proprietorship over how it should be understood, what the meanings of terms should be. So, of course, we see it in international relations, we see it in international law, we see it in Holocaust and genocide studies. But like as Mark Nishanian says in the historiographic perversion, genocide is not a fact. Le génocide n'est pas un fait. Genocide is not a fact because it is the very destruction of the fact, the notion of the fact, the factuality of the fact. So I think in thinking about this fraught history, on the one hand, we have the kind of geopolitical implications of calling something a genocide. On the other hand, we have the kind of negotiations about who should be the subject of it, the legal and doctrinal spaces. In the third instance, we have the kind of subsuming of the concept of genocide into Holocaust and genocide studies, which, you know, eclipses both the fact that the Nazi Holocaust in Europe was a colonial genocide and a racial genocide, because it wasn't spoken about that in the text of the Nuremberg trials, and also just the very concept of, you know, genocide as an event versus genocide as a structure, which very much shapes how we are thinking linguistically and meaningfully about what genocide is.
Thanks, Joe. And when you were saying all of that, I was also thinking, came to my mind this great, I think it started as a Twitter thread and then became an article in Africa is Not a Country by Mohamed El Naim, where he says that, you know, Europe, or, and I think he's really sort of singling out Germany here, but I think we can include quite a few other European countries within that, is that, you know, they've learned from the episode, right, but they haven't learned from the principle, right? And I think what you're speaking to there a lot is that, you know, we see, for example, Nazi crimes in Europe is a sort of episodal thing that should never happen again, but we haven't learned the principle of that. And it's interesting to sort of see the way that that's also some ways kind of built into the study of this. So it should be clear by now that I'm not really an expert in the study of genocide. So that's why I have you on. But I have, in prep for this episode, for this podcast, I've dipped my toes in the quite rough waters, I think I could say, of genocide studies. And I mean, it's a very diverse field. There's lots of disagreement. And you've started to kind of introduce us to some of the people that we should read that work on this, some of the differences in the debates that are animating the field. But could you recommend, are there any scholars whose work you think our readers should absolutely engage with for a deeper understanding of genocide?
Yeah. So I think that you're bringing it back to Germany is a really interesting kind of way to move into this, because there is, and I think this, so Dirk Moses's work, which, you know, which I think his new book, Permanent Security and the Language of Transgression, you know, is also I think would be very interesting for security studies scholars, for example, because you know, one of the ways that he is looking at the failures of the language of genocide to capture the actualities of it, and how instead states like, you know, we could say like Israel are trying to kind of establish a state of permanent security, which I think could really segue nicely into the whiteness of security as a paradigm. And I think that, you know, there was the German catechism debate, which I think is a really interesting one. And I think that you know, looking at Germany as a kind of site for this really leads to really interesting reflections on what to read, because, you know, this idea that the Nazi Holocaust was exceptional, that anti-Semitism, that there's a special debt kind of owed to it, to the state of Israel, because of the Nazi Holocaust. And really what we're seeing is that Europe's failures to denazify are really manifesting as genocide in Palestine, and also within Europe, extreme prohibitions on speech, resistance and racism towards, you know, Black people and Muslim people and Arab people in Europe and in Germany specifically, with a very specific understanding of anti-Semitism. So I think there's a few. So I think certainly Dirk Moses' new book is excellent. Zoe Samudzi's work, as I've mentioned a few times, is really, really excellent. I think Tina Kamp's The Other Germans just is a really important way of situating the kind of understanding of the Nazi Holocaust in relation to, you know, the broader questions of genocide. I think I'd say, you know, the work of Aimé Césaire is really central, you know, to thinking about, you know, what people call in kind of colloquial terms that, you know, the double standard, but really trying to understand genocide in context. I think Mark Nishanian's The Historiographic Perversion is really a superb book. I think Kamari Maxine Clark's work on international law, which is not necessarily specific to genocide, but really does capture a lot of the racial, both the affective registers and the kind of racial subjugations of international law, is really, really important. I think there's a fantastic new book by Guillaume Mourali called The Nuremberg Moment. And one of the things that book argues, which I think is really, really interesting, is that one of the reasons that the Nuremberg trials didn't pay particular attention to actual racial crimes against Jewish people and other victims of the Holocaust was because US prosecutors were concerned about their racism at home being kind of reflected in this international stage. I think Umar Ba's work in international relations is really, really interesting on tracing the kind of genealogies of legal regimes and the histories and how these kind of emerged. Owiso's work as well on race and international justice is really, really interesting there. And I think Siba Grover-Gui's, I have never gotten over Sovereigns, Quasi-Sovereigns and Africans, which also really kind of looks from the Namibian, I think within international relations is a really, really important one. So yeah, I think these, you know, in terms of the I tried to think when I looked at this question of the kind of the, and Noura Erekat's work, if you're looking at this question of Palestine specifically, I think Noura Erekat, Mesna Kwato, John Reynolds, who are doing really interesting work on the kind of relationships between the law and genocide. And then also, I think just to kind of bear in mind that there's been so much, as we see with the South African case at the moment, that so much of the more radical thinking has ironically in the field of international law, I mean, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but actually come from actors within the system. It's really one of the very few fields. You know, I've been tracing the work of the International Law Commission from 1983 to 1996, where it was trying to criminalize colonialism and apartheid as international crimes, alongside the kind of Nuremberg crimes. And there was this special rapporteur, Dudu Thiam, who was the first foreign minister of Democratic Senegal. And he was the one kind of pushing for this as an essential crime to be codified. So I think there's much in the archives as well.
So coming back to South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, and I'm sure many of our listeners, like me, have been following this. And I think it's the most exciting thing that's happened in The Hague for a long time. Maybe I'm just a little biased. and maybe like me, they spent their New Year's so I'm such a loser, reading all 84 detailed pages of the application, South Africa's application, instituting procedures against the state of Israel. Maybe some of them even went to The Hague for the hearings on the 11th and 12th of January, where there was a huge civil society presence in solidarity with Palestine and in support of South Africa's actions. And then in late January, following the ICJ's provisional ruling, perhaps they also read all 29 pages that outlined the court's rulings of possible genocide and the measures to be adopted by Israel, alongside the various judges' independent declarations and dissenting opinions. And in addition, maybe our listeners have been following the various responses to the initial South African application and the provisional ruling of the court. There's been many of them. For instance, my social media was full of people celebrating the ruling and others, many of them Palestinians, under bombardment in Gaza, expressing anger, right, that the ruling did not call for a ceasefire. And then, of course, this was alongside propaganda efforts to sort of spin the provisional ruling in favor of Israel by stating that the court had not ruled Israel's actions in Gaza to be a genocide, which, of course, completely missed that this is a provisional ruling in line with how the court operates. And so can I ask you about the politics of all this as a South African working in the field of critical genocide studies?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things that I feel, and I think I'm going to take the liberty of speaking as a kind of as a Jewish South African as well, who became South African, became, you know, whatever this settler colonial compact is, through, you know, ancestors who fled the pogroms and the Nazi Holocaust or went through Auschwitz, and to, you know, to think about it with these, you know, so to start off, I'd like to kind of start with 1948, which is the moment where the Genocide Convention is accepted by the General Assembly, and also the moment where an apartheid state is established in both Palestine and South Africa, connected apartheid states. So I think that's the first thing. I'm coming back to the temporal question, is that you have this moment where you have this absolute prohibition on, you know, racial subjugation in the form of genocide, annihilatory racial subjugation, at the same time as you have the literal Nakba and the establishment of these interconnected apartheid states, where you have the Israeli government also arming the apartheid South African government. So I think that's, you know, I just kind of start there as a kind of broad opening space. I think in terms of the order, within the limits of the law, the order handed down is kind of possibly the most radical it could be. As the minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor, South African Minister of International Relations, said, it would be very difficult to carry out the provisional measures without instituting a ceasefire. And I think that's one point. I think the other point that I've heard mentioned quite a bit in the South African context is that a ceasefire is an agreement between different parties, and the actor in question was Israel. And Israel could have chosen to, you know, enter into negotiations. Israel could have chosen to discontinue its genocidal onslaught, and instead it chose to only bolster it. So I think that's the other thing. I think in understanding, so a couple of points about that, that 84-page text that really stand out, and I think this is the first time we've rarely seen this, is that the genocide was situated within the context, and I think it's paragraph 3, within the context of apartheid and 75 years of occupation. And then in the oral arguments, they used the term, I think it was the agent that used the term, within the context of the ongoing Nakba. And so I think that is really significant. I think, in terms of the response to it, those who say it's kind of a loss or they, you know, the court really, that's a kind of propagandist line that I don't know how much attention. I mean, I suppose it does bear consideration. It's also difficult to talk from South Africa where there's so much support for it. And so I think that's one. In terms of Palestinians saying this is not enough, I mean, of course it's not enough. The law will never be enough. And so I am guided by that. I think there's Samira Esmer talks about juridical humanity quite a lot. And I think there's something for me that, you know, that this idea that we have to prove genocide is itself a kind of iterative process that on the one hand is deeply important because we know how the, you know, world order works. And if, you know, if this is proven to be genocide, then whoever is selling arms to Israel is, you know, Israel's not listening to the order. Powerful states very rarely listen to orders against them. I mean, the Chagos Islands case where the Mauritius took the UK to court for the incomplete decolonization of the Chagos Islands. The UK mentioned that it's a bilateral issue and has not taken any action on that. So I think that's, you know, that's important. I think that the very act of, you know, and this is the tension again, and maybe to sort of sit with the tension is to say, on the one hand, it is really important that this is outlawed or kind of stated in the legal archive as potentially genocide in as strong a language as the ICJ is capable to do at the provisional stage. And yet at the same time, the law, I think part of the problem is that the law is a tool, you know, and I think this is what anti-colonial lawyers have taught us. That the law is a tool, that things like BDS, that things like, you know, what the Houthis are doing in the ocean, that things like ways to be in solidarity with Palestine and Palestinians, with the resistance, the case has, in my understanding, and certainly in the South African context, opened up a space for a utility of the law in support of other forms of resistance to this genocide. And I think that's really important. I think anyone who thinks that the law itself is going to be any kind of panacea or salvation has not been paying attention. So I think it's part of an architecture of or arsenal or an inventory, perhaps, that it feels incumbent upon those of us who think with it and work with it to kind of mobilize with it, with whatever we can towards, you know, ending this. I mean, I'm just watching the news this morning about Rafah, and, you know, it's just obviously the law is not ending this. But how can we use it as part of our mobilizations and in deep solidarity and kinship?
Yeah, and I think that's really important. But I think absolutely that the law is not enough. But I also think, I mean, seeing it from someone who's in the Netherlands, who did not, to be honest, had a completely lost, entirely lost my faith in international legal systems or the legal system more generally, because back in November, we had a coalition of civil society organizations who took the Dutch government to court to get them to stop selling F-35 parts to Israel because they claimed that those parts could plausibly be used to commit war crimes in Gaza, and the court ruling in the favor of the state. And then following the ICJ ruling, the case was brought again, and the court ruled in, you know, the Dutch government has to stop selling F-35 parts to Israel because they could be in breach and potentially complicit in a plausible genocide, right? So, I mean, it has had repercussions, I think, for European politics. It has had repercussions for, or it's repoliticized and given legitimacy and momentum to calls for BDS, right? I mean, I was struck yesterday. I listened to the so this is not the case on genocide. This is the ICJ case on the legality of Israel's occupation. And I listened, and for all intents and purposes, in Philippe Sand's testimony to the court, I mean, he effectively calls for BDS. You know, he said that all states have to stop arming Israel. They have to stop sending aid. They have to stop sending money, right? So I think this sort of, to see that call in somewhere like the Peace Palace is really quite, I didn't think I'd see it in my lifetime, to be honest. Maybe it's because I'm an awful cynic, but I really didn't expect to see it. But at the same time, you know, we have European governments, North American governments, Australian governments cutting funding to UNRWA, right? Which you could argue is also a genocidal act, right? When UNRWA is such a fundamental actor in ensuring the necessary conditions for life of Palestinians, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria, right? It's almost like geographically, spatially expanding attempts at exterminating Palestinian life or eliminating Palestinian life. So I'm also sort of, there's this part of me that's super like, yay, mobilized, but at the same time, especially as someone working on humanitarianism, I mean, I just see this as the death of, I mean, what was left of the dying corpse of Western liberal humanitarianism is being entirely, it's floundering deeply, deeply. So yeah, I think it's important to sort of see the way that these things play out differently, right? And are animated in different, depending where you're situated. But no, so I think it's really interesting to sort of think about the way in which perhaps this has reanimated and maybe an interest in international law and genocide studies more broadly. So this brings me to my final question. And this is, what do these recent events mean for the practice and study of international law more broadly and genocide studies in particular? And what would you like to see the academic international relations community do considering these events? And what should we avoid doing as a community of scholars?
The first thing, and to come back to the kind of BDS point, is what can, you know, so I think, so let me speak to international law and international relations more specifically, because I think that's more where I'm kind of disciplinarily homed, I guess. I think the first thing is absolutely, we need an academic boycott, 100% academic boycott of Israeli institutions, recognizing that the kind of Israeli universities are absolutely essential to the upholding of settler colonization in Palestine, and military science and technology and the kind of production of narrative and the production of mythos and all of these things. So I think that's the one thing. Before I come to the kind of academic question, I mean, not that this isn't an academic question, but maybe it is, to say, what are the materialities of our research, right? What are the materialities of the spaces in which we do our research? Who is funding our universities, right? How much of the, so I think it would, it, you know, the kind of PACB stuff, the BDS stuff is really, really important. So, you know, the work that is being done, which is really impressive at many, many universities, looking at how much arms investment there is in universities, upkeep, who are the donors, how these donors are contributing, and again, and this is where I come back to, you know, this ambivalence about the law, that the university, you know, that this is actually a form of complicity in genocide, right? If you are making possible this, you know, the kind of, financing of genocide. So anyway, I think that would be a key thing. And I think, you know, I think consistently Israeli to say, you know, our research and our teaching doesn't happen in a vacuum. So how are our institutions complicit? How are the journals in which we publish complicit? What are our journals doing to make possible or impossible certain kinds of politics of either liberation or subjugation? What are we teaching our students? What kinds of conversations are we having with our students? Who are our students? What are we doing to make our university safe for Palestinian students? You know, what, and this is not to say a kind of either or question, but, you know, with Ukraine, there was very quickly kind of visas offered and student visa regimes in various places. You know, have we seen the same for Palestinian students? We now live in a context in which every university in Gaza has been bombed. So I think that that would be the one thing. I think I turned to that letter that was signed by 11 universities in Palestine that called for us. So, and then this is what I'm guided by. Whether I, you know, it was just to call for us to help work towards justice and accountability for the crimes that have been committed. That was the call. So I have been thinking about that call for a very long time as someone who is deeply imbricated within the world of international justice and accountability, but also critical of it. What do we, you know, are you, what are, you know, at the risk of going back to basics, from each according to his abilities to each according to his need, what are what are we, you know, what specifically can we do? Because you know, I'm very you know, very taken by call and response, and I think, you know, the call is there. I think it's and to recognize the kind of heterogeneity of calls. You know, I think there's also this idea that, you know, all Palestinians, they're one Palestinian, therefore all Palestinians, which is a particularly whitely colonial approach, you know, to say what can we do and what kind, you know, there's Israel Apartheid Month coming up in March. This year it's a month rather than a week. You know, what kinds of things are we doing in those spaces? What are, you know, what are we reading? Are we having reading groups with our students? Are we having teach-outs, teach-ins, these kinds of things? In terms of the kind of academic questions, you know, the big thing is you know, this in so many ways, even in critical traditions, this kind of post-1945 moment looms large as our overhanging kind of motif against which our research is happening. So, you know, so many of the people who were involved in the Nuremberg trials were involved in the emergence of the field of security studies. There were, you know, the thing about international law specifically, and, in, you know, is that so many practitioners and scholars are in, it's a revolving door. You know, Philippe Sands is a lecturer at UCL, right? Or yeah, so as UCL. So, you know, you have this, you know, this movement between spaces of practice and spaces of knowledge production. So what kind of knowledge are we producing that is fundamentally and in every single way possible with a clear view of a liberatory futurity, right? Settler colonization is ending. Settler colonialism has to end. How do we support resistance to it? Both in, sure, in the work we produce, but really a lot of the work we produce is unaffordable to most people and behind a paywall and peer-reviewed by, you know, in a for-profit industry of publishing. You know, what are we actually doing in terms of the materialities of knowledge production in ways that are fundamentally taking seriously our responsibilities as, you know, in preventing or supporting the quest for justice. And part of that is, sure, if you know, some of that is people who are evidency and, you know, collecting evidence, and that's really important, and archiving is really important. But I think part of it is really we need new grammars, we need new ways, and not necessarily new. I think they're there. I think new within a lot of the spaces of international relations, and revisiting some of the more radical traditions within the field that have existed, that have been asking these questions for 50 years, but that have been sidelined by a particular kind of citational loop in the field that privileges whiteness, and I say that a kind of global whiteness as a methodological whiteness, as a white empiricism, what Shonda Prescott Weinstein refers to as in science as white empiricism, as, you know, so how are we, you know, in our scholarly work, I guess, trying to think beyond the frames of the settler colonial internationalist system in which we write and which we are, you know, which we simultaneously are produced by and produce.
Thank you so much, Jo. When you're talking about the complicity of Israeli, or the centrality of Israeli universities in the occupation, I just finished reading Maya Wynn's Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. I recommend it to everybody. It's an absolutely fantastic look into this in much more detail. And in terms of grammars, I don't think we necessarily need new grammars. I think maybe we just need to be, and I'm saying we here, I mean, as a scholarly community, need to use existing ones that we have, but use them properly, right? So I am struck by and annoyed repeatedly by the framing of this as a conflict. As if this is, and there's been so much critical work unpacking why this is not a conflict. This is a liberation struggle against an illegal occupation, right? And as soon as you frame something as a conflict, you place particular expectations on particular actors. You see it as a, you know, two-sided thing, et cetera, et cetera. And also just to be less, and we repeatedly accuse the media of using passive voice. Right. Somehow, you know, Palestinians are just killed by bombs magically falling out of the sky. But I think as scholars, I see us doing this too. Right. We talk about, you know, the violence that is perpetuated on Palestinians, but we don't say who is doing the violence. We refuse to name things in the correct way. We refuse to effectively, I guess, engage in acts of condemnation or acts of simply drawing, you know, pointing out accountability and responsibility. And I think that's not only something that academics do. I see it across the humanitarian industry for whatever reasons. So I think we can all be clearer in using our existing grammars and in recognizing that, yeah, this is a liberation struggle. It's a struggle against 75 years of genocidal violence, and that as a scholarly community, we should, when we strive for accuracy in so many things, right, that we should push for accuracy when discussing Israel's ongoing deadly occupation of the Palestinians. That's my two cents worth, so we can stop, I think, unless you have anything else you want to add.
No, I think this is good. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.